Are you looking for a view of the world that's a bit different? Hi, I'm Jason Palmer, a host of The Weekend Intelligence, a podcast from The Economist. Join us to hear the stories that matter most to our correspondents and editors. Every Saturday, we introduce you to people and ideas that take you outside the ordinary and expand your horizons one episode at a time. Join us and see the world from a new perspective. To listen free until May 31st, search Spotify for The Weekend Intelligence.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the year leading up to the 2020 election, we're counting down the biggest scandals in American political history. This is number 23, the story of Boss Tweed. On October 27, 1871, William Tweed started the morning as he did each day, with a cup of coffee and the newspaper. There across the masthead was yet another headline excoriating him as a thief, a fat cat, and a robber baron. All he could do was shake his head and take another sip of coffee. But as he raised the cup to his lips, he heard a knock at his townhouse door and a gruff voice call out, "Police!"
Tweed had always known this day was coming. His arrest was years in the making. Estimates vary on just how much money he embezzled from New York taxpayers. Some put the figure at around $25 million. Others say up to $200 million. And now, for the first time in memorable New York history, justice was finally about to be served.
Welcome to Political Scandals, a Parcast original. I'm Richard.
And I'm Kate.
You can find all episodes of Political Scandals and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Political Scandals for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Political Scandals in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. Boss Tweed is a name synonymous with political corruption and scandal. At the height of his power, he was the head of Tammany Hall, a democratic political machine that controlled New York City. And he leveraged that power and influence to become one of the richest men in the country.
His portfolio of ill-gotten assets included stakes in mining, railroad, and gas companies, all of which were awarded valuable contracts by Tweed himself. He was the third largest landowner in Manhattan and a director of not one, but two national banks.
Tweed grew obscenely rich as the city and its taxpayers suffered. It was an ironic turn considering that before he was the king of New York City, he was a working-class child on the Lower East Side.
Tweed didn't experience a particularly charmed childhood. In 1834, he left school at the young age of 11 to apprentice under his chairmaker father. But it was in the Manhattan streets where he learned how to wheel and deal.
Tweed was raised in the Five Points District, one of the deadliest neighborhoods in New York City. It was a violent, poverty-stricken area teeming with gangs. Tweed himself was associated with the Bowery Boys, an anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, and anti-Irish gang.
Ironically, Tweed would rely heavily on Irish and immigrant support during his later career. But it was from the nativist Bowery Boys that Tweed got his street smarts. He would sit on stoops with his buddies all night until the sun rose, guarding their territory. Brawls with rival gangs were common and often devolved into riots.
Their main hub was a neighborhood firehouse, since like all the other local gangs, the Bowery Boys were all firemen. It was one way to stake territory and to make a little clean cash.
At the time, when there was a fire, whichever firehouse's team got there first would collect the payment from the city. What happened, naturally, was that the warring gangs would brawl on the streets, fighting for the privilege of putting out the fire.
It wasn't the most effective system. Sometimes by the end of the fight, the building would have already burned down.
But it was in this chaotic milieu that Tweed first distinguished himself. Even as a teen, Tweed was large and imposing, and he was often the first man off the horse-drawn fire engine. He'd usually carry an axe with him, unafraid of using the blunt end to knock a rival gang member to the ground.
By the time he was in his mid-20s, Tweed was a respected leader in his local fire department. He was violent and ruthless, sure, but he was also charming, with a larger-than-life personality and a loud laugh. And most importantly, he had a penchant for telling people what to do.
It was no surprise that when Tweed's first volunteer fire department disbanded, he became the foreman of a new gang called the Big Six. For its emblem, Tweed chose the image of a tiger mid-roar, and as foreman, he caught the eye of the local Democrats.
At the time, the Democratic Party bore little resemblance to what we know today. Throughout the early 19th century, Democrats were in favor of slavery and a small government, while Republicans, the anti-slavery party, were in favor of increasing government oversight. And if anyone was against government oversight, it was Boss Tweed.
Local Democratic leaders began inviting him for dinners, evening drinks, and late-night chats at men's lounges. They were so impressed by the young leader that in 1851, they encouraged him to run for the Board of Aldermen, the predecessor to New York City Council. He won at the tender age of 28.
Even before Tweed's rise to power, New York City politics were exceedingly corrupt. The malfeasance only increased in the 1850s once Tweed had a seat at the table.
He and his aldermen colleagues were soon referred to as the 40 Thieves. Their brand of corruption at this point was very low stakes and consisted mainly of extortion. For example, they might tell a business, generally one owned by an immigrant, that they couldn't open their doors until they paid a new business fee, a fee that didn't actually exist. Naturally, they would pocket the fee for themselves.
During Tweed's era, there was very nebulous justification for this kind of behavior. An alderman was an unpaid position, so from their point of view, the money they collected from these scams was basically just their salary.
Tweed's first lucrative scam as alderman occurred when he was put in charge of purchasing fireworks for a citywide party. The fireworks show was so grand and impressive that when he put in the bill, no one questioned the $4,100 price tag.
That's worth over $137,000 in today's money.
The actual cost of the display was only $500, equivalent to nearly $17,000 today. He overcharged the city by a whopping 700%.
Using a city fireworks show as an opportunity for graft is shameless, to say the least, but it gets worse. Not even school teachers were immune from extortion. As a self-appointed member of the New York City School Board, Tweed forced teachers to pay a large fee to register for a position, a fee that went directly into his own pocket.
Then, as now, teachers were not well compensated, and the fee usually amounted to about a third of their salary.
But Tweed usually came in person to collect those fees. At 300 pounds and with a reputation for violence, he wasn't the kind of guy you wanted to cross. So even if someone suspected that the charges were bogus, there wasn't much they were willing to do about it.
Despite Tweed's thuggish ways, or more likely because of them, in 1853, he was elected to Congress as a Democrat. He spent a relatively unexciting 2 years working in Washington, where it became clear that he wasn't a backbench, pencil-pushing bureaucrat like these congressmen. He was a shot caller.
And the people who call the shots rarely hold elected office. When he returned to New York, Tweed became an official member of Tammany Hall.
The Tammany Hall building, located in the Gramercy neighborhood of Manhattan, was the headquarters of the Society of St. Tammany. It began as a social club in 1789, catering mainly to new immigrants who were flooding into the neighborhood.
For these immigrants, Tammany was the only organization that stood up for them in a city that was generally hostile to newcomers. Many had no idea how to navigate New York City, how to find jobs, and some couldn't even speak English.
At Tammany, the immigrants found a sympathetic ear among the local Democratic politicians. But that sympathy came at a price. Before they lifted a finger to help, the politicians needed a commitment that the new immigrants would vote for them.
For the immigrants, it was a no-brainer. In their native countries, few had ever been helped at all by any elected official, much less had the opportunity to vote.
By collecting immigrant votes for their chosen political candidates, the organization built an almost unbreakable network of elected officials throughout all the ranks of New York government.
Tammany Hall functioned almost like a union. Members of the organization had to be nominated, pay dues, and prove that they had sway with certain groups of people. Notably, you guessed it, immigrants. But in return, the leaders of Tammany Hall fought for their politicians and almost always won.
The powerful network was considered an unstoppable machine. Almost every Democratic candidate in New York politics came out of Tammany Hall, and for over a century, their nominees never lost.
That was no coincidence. Tammany Hall's power went beyond the voting booths. They had endless political sway, they could grant big favors, and they had a lot of money. In that sense, it was more like a mafia than a union. And just like a mafia, it wasn't afraid of using violence.
On July 13, 1863, rioting broke out in the streets of downtown Manhattan. It came in response to the Enrollment Act, an order signed by President Abraham Lincoln initiating a military draft. The act also allowed for draftees to pay a commutation fee of $300, more than $5,500 in today's money, to avoid military service. It was a fee that no working-class New Yorker could afford.
Not only did many white working-class New Yorkers oppose joining the Union Army at the height of the Civil War, they feared that in their absence, their jobs would be taken by Black Americans who were not required to be drafted.
This frustration led to angry mobs, especially the Irish gangs, roaming the streets and attacking any Black people they could find. Not only that, they burned and looted several buildings, including the local draft office and the Colored Orphan Asylum. Several pro-war newspaper offices were also destroyed.
Throughout the chaos, the Tammany Democrats fanned the flames by riling up their base and railing against the draft order. It's unknown whether they encouraged the violence, but they don't seem to have done anything to prevent it.
Finally, after 4 days, the riots subsided. In the aftermath, 120 people were dead, including 12 Black men who were lynched. Throughout the ordeal, Tammany Hall stuck firmly by its members, even offering to pay their commutation fees. As a result, allegiance to the organization not only grew stronger, but gained a second group of loyal devotees, German immigrants.
Just as Tammany's power and influence was reaching its zenith, so was William Tweed. By the time the riots broke out, he'd worked his way up to the very top of the organization's ladder. And he had a plan to expand their reach even further.
Up next, we'll learn how Tweed wielded Tammany Hall to become the most powerful and terrifying man in New York City.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, back to the story.
Throughout the 1850s and early 60s, William Tweed shot to the top of the Tammany Hall political machine like a bolt of lightning. By 1863, the 40-year-old Tweed was firmly in charge. He was given the title of Grand Sachem, the head of the General Committee.
This, not surprisingly, is how he earned his nickname, Boss Tweed.
In this new role, Tweed controlled Tammany Hall's nominations for all city positions. He had to approve each and every candidate, and once he had someone in mind, their victory was a foregone conclusion. Tweed once quipped, "I don't care who does the electing, as long as I do the nominating."
Tweed knew that he could count on the immigrants and working-class New Yorkers loyal to Tammany Hall, and he proceeded to fill the city government with friends who could do his bidding.
While Tweed certainly exploited the loyalty of his immigrant base, he also rewarded them. He provided jobs and oversaw the construction of shelters, soup kitchens, orphanages, and hospitals.
While a great deal of taxpayer money went into his pocket, much of it also went towards Catholic schools and charities. But Tweed was more concerned with growing rich than Irish Catholic children getting a good education.
Beyond his voter base, Tweed could count on loyalty from his inner circle. In return, his friends were appointed as the district attorney, the comptroller, the city recorder, just to name a few. Sometimes he simply made up jobs and titles when he wanted to put someone in power. And all of these friends worked in the same shady style as he did.
As Grand Sachem, Boss Tweed created a small executive committee within Tammany Hall, nicknamed the Tweed Ring. The Tweed Ring was New York's Olympic team of corruption. They overcharged businesses. They billed for services not rendered. They bribed voters, businessmen, and politicians. And all the while, they treated themselves to very expensive lunches.
Not only did they make life more difficult for business owners, they actively undermined the economic progress of the city by siphoning off all its money. At this point, Tweed simply began buying entire businesses that he would then hire to do work for the city and award with lucrative contracts.
For example, Tweed purchased the New York City Printing Company, which naturally became the city's printer for everything from flyers to billboards.
He bought the Manufacturing Stationers Company, too, an outfit that just so happened to provide all the paper for the printing company, at a significant markup, of course, and all of it fueled by taxpayer money.
The Tweed machine also controlled construction. Parks, streets, bridges, hospitals. Architects knew that if they wanted the job, they had to pay Tammany Hall for the contract.
In fact, Tweed's most spectacular and audacious act of corruption was the construction of one such municipal building, the Tweed Courthouse. Because of the influx of new citizens, New York needed more municipal buildings. And since Tweed had a seat on virtually every city board, construction of a new courthouse became his pet project.
The project broke ground in 1861, but it would take nearly 10 years to complete. And during that time, Tweed found every possible way he could to line his pockets with city funds. The contracts Tweed awarded, and subsequently skimmed from, were almost comical, or they would have been if they hadn't been ripping off hardworking taxpayers.
Originally, $250,000 was set aside for the building, worth about $7.3 million today. By the time construction was completed, the cost was 56 times that. A single carpenter earned over $360,000, roughly $10.5 million in today's money, for a single month's labor, in a building that contained very little woodwork. The plasterer, who happened to be a Tammany Hall functionary, received a staggering $133,000 for 2 days' work.
A furniture maker received nearly $180,000, equivalent to $5.2 million today, for 3 tables and 40 chairs.
Certainly, Tweed could have hired his chairmaker father at a cheaper price.
If this somehow wasn't egregious enough, Tweed was also part owner of a quarry that provided the marble for the courthouse.
By the end, it's estimated that the Tweed Ring embezzled a total of $14 million during the project, equal to a staggering $410 million today.
And as his empire grew, so did his wardrobe. He wore tailored suits fitted with his hallmark, a large diamond at his shirt front. Not everyone was awed by his wardrobe choices, though. Tweed's clothing was mercilessly satirized in the press.
So were some of his other habits. While he wasn't a drinker or smoker, Tweed was an indulgent eater who spent lavishly on heaping portions of oysters and duck à l'orange. As a result, the Tweed Ring was jokingly referred to as the Lunch Club.
But despite the criticism from the press, by the time the election of 1868 rolled around, Tweed had more power and influence than ever.
The 1868 election is what really propelled Tweed to the height of his power and infamy. And he did it through an old, trusted tactic: voter fraud.
When it came time for an election, the Tammany Hall politicians didn't care if the immigrants voting for them were documented or not. In fact, they made an active effort to recruit undocumented immigrants.
To do so, they simply recorded their names, then printed hundreds of fake citizenship cards, on Tweed paper, of course, to ensure their participation.
But most importantly, they paid them to get out and vote.
On election day, well-dressed young men from Tammany Hall strolled the immigrant neighborhoods with new suits and pockets full of cash. As soon as they could confirm that a loyal immigrant had voted for their candidate, the wad of cash got a little lighter. It was a practice they called walking around money.
Tammany also hired assistant policemen for election day. These otherwise unqualified men in uniform were ostensibly on duty to make sure that no fraud occurred, aside from the fraud that was sanctioned by Tammany Hall.
Anyone who wanted to question the men from Tammany Hall had their work cut out for them. Anyone who interfered would be arrested and not allowed to vote.
Even the sheriff at the time, James O'Brien, received a generous kickback for looking the other way.
But many refused to look the other way, especially the local press. Newspapers referred to the election results as a nice little arrangement for Tammany Hall. All of Tammany's nominees won in New York, except for the presidential candidate, Horatio Seymour, who lost to Republican Ulysses S. Grant.
The 1868 election was just one part of a larger plan. It all culminated in a document called the Tweed Charter, which gave control of the city's finances, among other things, to the Tweed Ring.
In 1857, the state of New York had ratified a charter that put the city finances in the hands of metropolitan boards, which were much like the boards of a corporation, where many people got to vote and interject. The more people on a metropolitan board, the harder it was for Tweed to bribe them all.
When the charter passed in 1870, it disbanded the boards and gave full control of the city's purse to the Tweed Ring, meaning they were the only people who could access the treasury.
To create the illusion of oversight and transparency, the Tweed Charter also stated that any expense in the city had to be approved by a board of audit.
A board that just so happened to be composed of the Tweed Ring and provided no oversight or transparency.
The charter passed through the legislature, not surprisingly, as a result of bribery. And by 1870, the Tweed Ring had literally no supervision from anyone else in the city. They were able to embezzle virtually as much as they wanted without fear of retribution. Not that they seemed particularly worried before.
The resulting bribes and fraudulent charges robbed the city of millions and millions of dollars, certainly the equivalent of billions today.
By this time, however, Tweed's public image was taking a beating. The city economy was failing. Crime rates were up. Properties were in disrepair. Public spaces were run down. And the only places the city was developing were the properties the Tweed Ring had a financial stake in.
Tweed supporters fell into two basic categories: working-class immigrants who were swayed by his all-for-show charity donations, and of course, politicians who benefited from his rule. But the Tweed Ring was becoming a regular target of the press. And when the truth made its way back to these loyal voters, Tweed's kingdom of corruption would crumble to the ground.
Up next, we'll see how the Tweed Ring collapsed.
Now, back to the story.
By the 1870s, Boss Tweed had reached the height of his power. The Tweed Ring controlled 12,000 city jobs and every penny spent for public service and works.
They also controlled every aspect of the city's government. Tweed was not only the leader of Tammany Hall. According to the New York Times, he was also the school commissioner, assistant street commissioner, president of the Board of Supervisors, and chairman of the New York Democratic Committee.
But by this point, people began wondering why the city's treasury fund was drying up, particularly the reporters who were already familiar with Tweed and Tammany Hall.
Up until now, he'd been more of a curiosity, but the graft had reached the point where no one could ignore it. Journalists were printing story after story accusing him of corruption. But Tweed dismissed the accusations, and they did nothing to sway the support of his loyal base.
A bigger problem was that Tweed was the favorite subject of political cartoonist Thomas Nast at Harper's Weekly. In one of his famous portraits, Tweed was depicted as a huge man in a fancy suit with a bag of money for a head. These drawings did more damage to Tweed's public image than anything else. While many of his constituents didn't know how to read, they did know how to interpret those cartoons.
But cartoons alone couldn't bring down Tweed and his massive network of corrupt politicians. That happened in an even more ridiculous way. Their bookkeeper died.
In January, James Watson, the county auditor and Tweed's paymaster, was kicked in the head by a horse in a tragic sledding accident. He died a short time later.
By a stroke of terrible luck, the position of auditor was appointed by one of the few elected officials in town who wasn't Tweed's crony. Which meant that when Watson died, Tweed didn't get a say in who replaced him.
The replacement auditor, Matthew J. O'Rourke, was not in on the crime ring, and he was now in possession of some very shady paperwork.
O'Rourke immediately noticed that the books didn't add up. Incensed by what he saw, he quit his job in protest, but not before making copies of a few particularly egregious ledgers.
The Tweed Ring offered O'Rourke a $5 million bribe to stay quiet, which he flatly refused. Instead, he brought the proof of embezzlement directly to the New York Times.
On July 29, 1871, the headline ran in big bold type, "Gigantic Frauds of the Ring Exposed." Tweed knew his time was up. In a few short days, he started handing over his assets and investments to family members. He wanted to make sure his wife and 10 children could keep themselves afloat when it all came crashing down.
Tweed and the Democrats controlled most of New York City's politics, but there were some high-ranking Republicans who were just waiting for something like this to break. And outside the city, in the capital of Albany, there were even more.
In the immediate aftermath of the New York Times expose, these Republicans and numerous Democrats who had fallen out of favor with Tammany Hall met to discuss the political reform they'd been dreaming of. They needed to strike when the iron was hot.
Right away, they cut off the city's funding and essentially overturned everything the Tweed Charter had put in place. Within a few short weeks, they'd formed a new board called the Executive Committee of Citizens and Taxpayers for Financial Reform of the City. It would be responsible for rebuilding the city's finances and slowly repairing the damage done by years of criminal activity and embezzlement. A new comptroller, Andrew Haswell Green, was appointed. He began to free up finances immediately so they could be accessed by different city sectors. New York City could finally breathe a sigh of relief.
William Tweed could not. The fateful knock on his door came in early August of 1871. He was charged with larceny and hundreds of misdemeanors. He was later released on $1 million bail. He still had friends with money, after all.
During the trial, which ironically was held in the courthouse Tweed had built, the jury was unable to reach a unanimous verdict. As a result, Tweed walked free. His freedom, however, was short-lived.
The state of New York brought a civil suit against Tweed in November of that year for the same charges. And this time, he was found guilty. He was forced to abandon all of his city positions, resign from Tammany Hall, and relinquish every cent he'd stolen from the city treasury.
Without any money to pay what remained of his debts, he was sentenced to 12 years in debtor's prison. Just like that, Tweed went from being one of the city's richest and most powerful men to one of the poorest.
As a condition of Tweed repaying the hundreds of millions he stole, he was allowed to visit his home once a month, presumably to make arrangements for selling businesses and assets. On December 4th, 1875, Tweed escaped during one of those visits home. It's hard for a 6-foot, 300-pound man to vanish into thin air, but he did it. Then he hopped over to Spain and began working as a seaman.
The U.S. government went looking for him, however. In a tragically humorous turn of events, Tweed was turned over to the police at the Spanish border after he was recognized because of Thomas Nast's cartoons.
Tweed was returned to New York and went right back into the slammer, where he would spend the rest of his days.
Tweed died in prison 3 years later. With his literal last breaths, he blamed his downfall on the New York State Attorney General and the governor who rose to power as Tweed went down. He said with a smile, "I hope they're satisfied now."
Tammany Hall outlived Boss Tweed by nearly a century. Even after being purged of its most corrupt elements, it was still an important fixture in New York City politics.
The organization experienced a major resurgence at the turn of the century. By this point, the ethnic communities it had originally manipulated had morphed into a powerful faction of working and middle-class voters. This reliable faction allowed Tammany Hall's politicians to once again occupy nearly every office in the city and even expand their reach to the state capital.
But the organization failed to endorse Franklin D. Roosevelt in the presidential election of 1932, a mistake it never recovered from. As its influence began to wane, several Tammany Hall-backed politicians were found guilty of crimes ranging from tax evasion and fraud to bribery, and it once again became a symbol of everything wrong with politics.
In the late 1950s, Tammany leader Carmine DiSapio's relationship with Frank Costello, who at the time was the city's most notorious gangster, brought even more scrutiny onto the organization. By 1967, Tammany Hall completely dissolved.
A new group of decidedly less corrupt Democrats, known as the Village Independent Democrats, led by Ed Koch, became the face of the Democratic Party in New York City. At least for now, it looks like the city's darkest days are over. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Scandal Number 22. Before Watergate hit the news, Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, was involved in his own totally unrelated corruption scandal.
You can find all episodes of Political Scandals and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Political Scandals on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Political Scandals in the search bar. We'll see you next time.
Political Scandals was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Billy Pace, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Political Scandals was written by Anna Kira Stinson, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Kate Leonard and Richard Rossner.